sixth, amendment to...
Apparently.
Back again, so...
Kinda like a rubber ball.
That's right, we'll try to get rid of it this time.
Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2212.
Representative Patridge moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2212. Are there any objections? Hearing seen none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2212 with a two-pass as amended recommendation to the consent calendar.
Representative Patridge moves we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2212 with a two-pass as amended recommendation to the consent calendar. Are there any objections? Hearing seen none, so ordered. A motion to the bills before us.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash seven amendment.
Well, I think we need to remove the dash six amendment.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that we remove the dash six amendments to House Bill 2212.
Representative Patridge moves that we remove the dash six amendments to House Bill 2212. Any objection? Hearing seen none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash seven amendments to House Bill 2212.
Representative Patridge moves the dash seven amendments to House Bill 2212.
Why don't you finish it up, Representative Wall?
Well, we have a King's X motion.
Is there any discussion?
It works for me.
Is there any objection? Hearing seen none, so ordered.
It worked for me 2 weeks ago.
Representative Lowe, we've amended the bill. You want to send it to the floor?
Yeah, let's do that.
Representative Lowe moves House Bill 2212 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing seen none, so ordered. Representative Lowe, is it a motion to send it to the consent calendar?
It is.
Representative Lowe moves that House Bill 2212 be moved to the consent calendar. Discussion? Any objection? Hearing seen none, so ordered. Yes, as amended. Let's do this one next.
Yeah, that's fine.
Let's open up a work session on House Bill 3372. Mark, you want to...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3372 requires Department of Administrative Services and state agencies to implement a portfolio-based management of information technology resources. It requires the department to develop and implement a plan for managing distributed information technology assets. Mr. Chair.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3372.
Representative Patridge moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 3372. Discussion?
I just want to let Representative Lowe know what I'm attempting to do by these amendments. And you, Mr. Chair, these amendments basically ask for the CJIS agencies and Section 3, page 2, lines 10 through 22 were included at the request of Legislative Council to clarify a change in that particular statute. But the addition of Section 4... into this, or the addition of this into House Bill 3372 would accomplish for the CJIS agencies what I feel like we've been trying to accomplish and put in a budget note and wasn't completed last session. We did put it in a budget note again this session. But I ask the CJIS agencies to come forward and present a budget plan by December 31st of even-numbered years, so that's prior to each legislative session, to prioritize how they are moving towards an enterprise solution for data integration, data sharing for the CJIS agencies, and how that plan is prioritized and the money that's attached to that. So rather than the budgeting committees and other people looking at each individual CJIS agency in a silo, to give us a broad-based picture of what the criminal justice information management technology plan will look like as a whole. I wanted to spell that out specifically, so this would be one of the early agencies to do this, I hope.
Any further discussion?
So does this mean that you're going to reschedule all the stuff that you've unscheduled?
No, they're still going to come back to us with a plan this time. But what this is doing is establishes that they're going to come forward prior to every legislative session with a prioritization package of why they invested in the particular information technology packages that they did.
Okay.
And how that meets with the enterprise solution. So consequently, instead of viewing a budget in a silo, we're actually looking at a criminal justice community and how we're spending dollars. Does that make sense?
Makes wonderful sense. My only concern is to make sure a part of what we've been doing has caused me some concern because I've seen some of the entities within the CJIS system bending over backwards and doing everything in their power to be cooperative and to come up with a good plan and that sort of thing, while other members have been less enthusiastic in their response to the request. And I don't want those entities that really have done a very good job to suffer at the hands of us or future legislatures. So to the extent that this lumps everybody together and makes them all come to the table at the same time, I think that that's probably wise. So I think I can live with it.
I think my comment to Representative Lowe is that this brings an opportunity to identify those parties that aren't coming up, and so it brings an opportunity to come back to the legislature to have a discussion as to why. So you can review the policy. It's either we're not funding it properly, or there's no the proper controls aren't there, or it's just somebody's decided they don't agree with the policy, and then you can have a discussion at that level each legislative session.
Perhaps that what this will eventually evolve into is a different way of budgeting the whole
Yes.
Oh, I get it. I'm a little slow on the uptake sometimes, but hey.
That's exactly, you hit the point right on the head,
yeah.
Representative Lowe. That's the point, is to look at the budget instead of in silos, to look at where's the tactical and best investments to make in public safety, look at it as a whole. UI or Representative Hill may not be here next legislative session, and this would carry, I believe that this statute would carry forward. Uh-oh, Grant, are you laughing at us?
No. He's laughing at me. I get it.
All right, but this would perpetuate that,
yeah.
And at least bring to the next legislature the plan as a whole.
Yeah,
we won't have Representative Hill's expertise unless he's going to be the term limits challenger or something.
You never know.
Never can tell.
You never know.
Mr. Zane, are you going to pop up and...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike Zane, and I'm the Chief Information Officer for Oregon State Police. I also serve as the chair for the CJIS Advisory Board. I think we can work with the Dash 2 amendments that I've seen. I think we would welcome the opportunity to get some time with you, Representative Patridge, to even try to develop a template between now and the time that we have to report back as far as how that budget prioritization might look like. So as we go off and we do that, we make sure that we're kind of hitting the mark. And so we'd welcome the opportunity to work with you on that. I think the other, I guess, concern that I would raise is There are IT investments that go on within the CJIS partner agencies that don't necessarily deal directly with IT integration. And I think I've not had the opportunity to review these amendments with the CJIS community, so I'm out here a little bit on a limb. But understanding the fact that there still needs to be IT investments in the business systems that support some of the primary needs of those agencies, we would be concerned about lumping all of the IT investments into one pot and then trying to prioritize those when clearly some of them are going to be focused on supporting just the needs of those business systems that have to go on independent of the integration goals that we've discussed.
And just let me, and I would like to put on the record to clarify that for the CJIS agencies, that this is not intended to say everything, only technology investments can only be towards integration. There are obviously technology investments that need to be made to stay in compliance with federal, state, federal and state statutes. There are obviously technology investments that need to be made just as routine investments to restore, repair, and continue to maintain current infrastructure. So I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying they need to present the criminal justice world as a world and say, this is why we made the technology investments, and this is why we only made X amount in integration versus these line investments that we have because we have to comply with this federal statute or that particular mandate.
Any further questions, discussion, Mr. Zane?
Thank you.
Could, as a part of this, can we have a review of this concept? Is there a sunset or some sort of a review of the approach that we're taking so we can evaluate whether or not our thinking as legislators is working to meet the goals that you've articulated, or if it's counterproductive to the operation of the different entities that partners in CJIS?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, I think that the CJIS statute that's been in place for a long period of time asks them to do basically some of this. The only thing it doesn't ask them to do is present a plan to the legislature.
Oh, I see. But this asks them to do the planning every year. I don't see what that hurts. Am I missing something?
Wasn't intended to do that. Let me look at this. Hold on one second. Page 2. So let's just take that out.
Yeah. Okay.
You just don't want me to interlineate. There's a problem with this amendment. They included another amendment. They incorporated another amendment in there.
Grant, can I come up?
Let me see if I can do it.
Welcome, sir.
Mr. Chairman, you're in work session, or?
We are in work session, sir.
Well, I had some testimony I wanted to give you on your posted public hearing, but if we're going to go to work session, I can make those comments very brief. Would that serve your purpose?
Do you need the opportunity to say your piece? May I ask where the chancellor is?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Grant and Karen is Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System. The Chancellor is in Klamath Falls today. He'll be in Medford tomorrow. Has another busy schedule next week, including a accreditation team meeting at OSU, followed by a board meeting, and will be in Washington, D.C. the week after. Has a meeting with Secretary Page, which we've been able to arrange for him. Returns to Salem in the first week of May. So I'm here in his stead.
Okay.
Hi. Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, the Oregon University System is a public agency created by the legislature in 1929 and is now in its 72nd year of operation. It has a varied history going back over that time, which I'm thankfully not going to collapse into my comments today. But I will say that the current management philosophy that the board, the chancellor's office, and the administration of the campuses have developed in recent years really runs in a different orbit than does the operating philosophy of 3372. And in fact, with its implementation, we would probably collide with it, our management philosophy being somewhat different than that expressed by the bill. That really comes as a result of three rather giant stair steps which the system has taken over the last 6 years, first with House Bill, Senate Bill 271, the Higher Education Administrative Efficiency Act, which decoupled the state system from DAS relative to purchasing, contracting, personnel, travel, printing, an entire panoply of back shop business activities. You had a material given to your subcommittee and probably in your possession a review of that bill. It has saved approximately $7 million a biennium of embedded ongoing efficiency costs.
And we have not received that. We have not received that.
Your subcommittee, your Ways and Means subcommittee has that in its packet and was delivered to all the members of it, all of whom here are members of that subcommittee. If you wish, I can supply this committee with additional copies. Would that be satisfactory? Happy to do it. Second, that was 6 years ago, and that has resulted in significant embedded efficiency savings, all of which were directed from the business side of our business into the instruction budget. 4 years ago, the legislature and the state board took the next stair step in passage of Senate Bill 919. There's an implementation report which is given to you, and if you wish, we'll, for your files of this committee, supply additional copies of that. And that inculcated into statute the four chief goals of the board: access, quality, cost effectiveness, which is an issue here, and employability of graduates. And that efficiency issue goes to how the board will then go and measure under the assessment requirement of Senate Bill 919, both of the Chancellor's Office, of campuses and their administration. And in fact, the presidents and their evaluation by the board on an annual basis include a review as to the efficiency and business management practices they employ, especially relative to fund balances and the efficiency they've been able to accomplish. Third, of course, was the adoption of the resource allocation model by this legislature 2 years ago. So 6 years, 4 years, 2 years, finds ourselves, as I would say, in a much different orbit from that which would be expressed by this bill. The result of those changes has been greater autonomy, both from the system and its relationship to state government, and then, most importantly, the campuses to the board and the system itself. The changes link resources and outcomes at the campus level and give to the board and the chancellor the obligation to assess how those linkages work in real time and whether satisfactory outcomes, both budgetarily and academically, are achieved. And most importantly, responsibility and accountability on all the measures which the board uses to assess achievement are joined at the decision maker's level. So whoever is responsible for the decision also has accountability. In your subcommittee yesterday, you heard from Kirk Pedersen regarding one of the trailing issues that came to us as a result of the old style of doing business, in which accountability and responsibility were divided. And you were able to simply run your college or department without regard to the bottom line because the campus budget would absorb it, and if not, the system budget would. And if that didn't work, you'd go ask for some more money. That no longer pertains. Under the new model, both in budgeting, both in goal setting and assessment, and under the Efficiency Act, the problem remains with the person who created the problem. So the decision maker's desk has both accountability and responsibility on it. And these are organized around best practices, both in the academic side of our business, but also, and most importantly, relative to this bill, best practices in business and efficiency as a central issue. Now, if you were to do a linguistic analysis of this measure relative to the business practices of the OUS, you go down the OUS side of the scale and you would find distributed, entrepreneurial, unified accountability and responsibility, opportunism, empowerment, and efficiency. We would go through this bill from our perspective, we would find centralized, controlling, divided accountability and responsibility, predetermination, and pre-authorization, although I understand there are amendments that are coming forward which may address that concern. And it's that collision, Mr. Chairman and members, that we're most concerned with. You can pass the bill, impose the process on us. We will gladly execute it, cause it to happen, and go forward. But it is at odds with the distributed and more autonomous process we go through. Now,
Grandwell, I understand what you're saying. In looking at the OUS budget on the budget committee, it's probably of the budgets that we've looked at for IT, there were no performance measures that were put forth. There were no criteria that were put forth upon which the decisions were made on which technology investments were made. You know, they may feel like I criticized the CGIS group, but we haven't got started with the OUS, and we're the ones who have been asked to spend the money.
Right.
But it appears that there's no accountability or controls on what's going on with OUS, with enterprise management, with any of those kinds of things. And so I don't know how you accomplish that. So what do you propose if you don't like this bill, what do you propose?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Patridge, I didn't publish more than one copy of my bullet points and I've only got a couple more. But I think you certainly read my notes. The answer would be as follows. Under the overarching principles of both state statute and board policy, we have, and you've got in your possession, and if not, we'll supply more to this committee, the Financial Administration Standard Operating Manual. Now, this is FASA. I'm not going to read it to you. But it says that we are to establish competitive procedures that are flexible enough to allow campuses to purchase and contract in a way that most suits their institutional organization.
Granton, let me interrupt you for a moment. I mean, this is all well and fine, but let's just get down to the bare facts. The Oregon University System has been unable and incapable of producing documentation of the money that they've spent on information technology. You had 3 weeks to produce the information. You were working with the consultant for 3 weeks prior to coming to the Ways and Means Committee. You showed up and you said, we can't do it, we need more time. You need 2 additional weeks. I have not seen anybody be able to come forward and articulate how you manage information technology. You read off a nice bunch of words about entrepreneurship and independence, you know, but that is all a load of crap. Because if you cannot come here to this body and articulate how you manage those dollars.
I'm attempting to do so, sir.
Well, you are reading a document, but yet you have not been able to produce any information from the university system that articulates how your budget is, where those budget dollars go, and who is accountable for them.
Mr. Chairman, as I say, I'm on the third of 5 points. The fourth is fairly direct. Let me say that my testimony will, by the time I reach the bottom of it in a minute or two, give you some direction regarding that question. And I think it goes to the issue of how we are looking at this enterprise. I think there is a decided difference and disagreement about how we look at our enterprise and how you're looking at this particular element or discrete issue within our enterprise. I think that's self-evident. But before I would finish, I want you to understand that indeed we do have principles of business practices. They are included in this document. I've only highlighted a couple, and I won't read you the document. reduce prior approvals and ensure accountability through auditing. I can tell you that...
It was in the passage.
Ron, when was that document adopted?
This was adopted October 20, 1995.
It's been in place for 5 years?
This is what follows on exactly from the adoption of the Senate Bill 271, which distributed...
Well, I just wanted to know the timeline. Yeah. I'll let you finish your testimony. I just want to know what the timeline is.
All right. Three, generate and retain only necessary documentation. Four, develop procedures that allow campuses to use the most appropriate procurement methods and encourage innovation. Allow campuses to work cooperatively with each other and other governmental units. And six, allow institutions to do business more easily with local and regional vendors. It really was a decentralization and an empowerment process. But we didn't just turn them loose, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. The document also includes a requirement on and the ethical model, the model public contract rules as promulgated by the Attorney General's office, and the business practices of it. Happy to supply another copy of that. We operate under the overarching Oregon administrative rules as adopted by the state board on acquisition of personal services, competitive procedures for purchasing, procurement, and contracting of goods and services. So you have state statute, board goals, system rules, business FASM standard, and then you have campus administration. What we don't have, Mr. Chairman, is a method of creating for IT a stovepipe of data collection and analyzation, which goes from the lowest desk where a person makes a decision regarding an IT purchase for a department, all the way up through the state board, back to DAS, and then to you. And I confess we do not have that. However, we do have a process that watches on a regular basis. I attend every meeting of the Administrative Affairs Council of the Oregon University System, which is made up of the vice presidents for finance and administration of each of the campuses. They meet 7 or 8 times a year. They have below them on each of their campuses a business cabinet or business council, and they operate directly under these administrative rules and business guidelines to accomplish the goals. And again, they do not, we do admit, they do not put up a screen, capture, collate, categorize, or otherwise compile this kind of data. But I want to make one point here that I think, I hope, gives you some idea of where we're coming from. We also don't do this for the libraries. We spend $33 million in this biennium on library acquisitions. We spend more on librarians than we do on IT, as hard as that is to believe. We have more of them, and they're more ubiquitous. We have sub-libraries in science, in mathematics, in computer science, and we don't capture that data either regarding the acquisitions for a $33 million division, because that would be another stovepipe. Then there'd be one for the physical plant. There might be one for academic disciplines. Mr. Chairman, we're not organized on that basis. We operate on a different process.
So there's no clearinghouse before somebody orders a book that they don't check the other library systems to make
Mr.
sure
Chairman,
there's not a duplicate book out there. Every university just willy-nilly orders their own book. Everyone has their own budget. They can do what they want.
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
That's all we're asking for on the IT side.
Yeah, and IT, they don't do that either. The IT
well,
directors,
that's what it appears like from the budget presentation. So,
Mr. Chairman,
I don't know what they do.
Mr. Chairman, I know that the IT directors work collegially. They work with OHSU, and they work with other, they work with community colleges, they work with state governments.
So there are some stovepipes.
They work this way, Mr. Chairman and Representative Patridge, across the institution. The management of the of the enterprise is based on goals, guidelines, and then operational procedures, which are campus-based, but they do cooperate across, collegially across them. I would say for libraries, it is very clear that as we have a number of interlibrary consortia that we have a membership in. We run two of the biggest ones in this state. So the answer would be directly, no, we don't let people go willy-nilly buy stuff. We don't have enough money for that. We follow a practice of the most efficient, cost-effective answer in any case, in any division, by virtue of the limited resources. As you heard yesterday, I was putting my hand up, pointing at myself yesterday in your subcommittee, when the issue was of what happens to redundant machinery. We don't have any. It gets pushed down. I'm a second user. People in my staff will be a third user. It will go out to someone else to be a fourth user, and on and on. The same is true in libraries, physical plant, and everything else. The analogy is that, no, we don't have that kind of... But if it's your goal to do that, we have three things we would suggest you do. And, Mr. Chairman, you asked that we report to our interests, and I would say the first one is very clear. Exempt the OUS. We'd appreciate it because we think we have, as I say, a collision between an overarching management philosophy built on the three giant stair steps we've taken in the last 6 years, and would think that this would be in keeping with the philosophy that we're operating with. Now, it may be that you don't like that one. I have another one which I think is critical, very critical, and that is to exempt all research and research grants and contracts. We can do that. It is a $700 million biannual enterprise, and we believe that given the IT purchases that are associated with those grants and contracts and the timelines of those, we would like to exclude them. That would be most beneficial. And failing that, Mr. Chairman, we have another suggestion that you put an appropriation line in this bill to fund the administrative costs. Because what will happen is, if you succeed in passing the bill, if we are included, we will obey the law and do what is required, but we will shift from other sources the personnel and resources to accomplish the creation of a screen which will capture the data and do what is required under the law. Given the fact that we have a zero-sum game, in fact a zero-minus game under this budget, we are very jealous about where we would direct dollars in order to create that new screen and create that new catchment system to provide the state with the data that this bill would require. And recognizing that we can't. While the cost may be relatively low, our fiscal folks in Eugene, the Chancellor's office, estimated it would be less than 5% of the IT budget in order to create, all the way down to the departmental level, within that campus, the budget officer in each department of each college to accumulate the data and report it and see if it's actually properly done under statute, and that we could otherwise comply with the law, that it would be a significant burden. It would be also, and I have to be very clear about this, Mr. Chairman, about 10th on our list of things that we would go out and acquire right now, given the fact that our budget is underfunded. We are at the 44th percentile of the average of our peers in funding for the instruction budget. The governor's budget as printed would take us down 10% to the 40th percentile of the range of our peers, leaving us with faculty who are not competitive in their wages, with a a tuition proposal which will take us from a D minus in terms of access under the Measuring Up 2000 report to an F in the coming biennium, which is a deep concern to us. We are pushing a $400 million unfunded deferred maintenance capital repair budget, which is unaddressed. And it would be quite a while before we work down to the point of saying we want to create a data collection, catchment, processing, and reporting system on IT to do this in a way which would be standing here on an organization which runs not parallel to it, but in conflict to it. And that, Mr. Chairman, would be the end of my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Grattan, this is asking that you have all these business plans and everything else. All we're doing is asking you to link your IT spending to the business plans that are already in effect for the Oregon University system. And there is no linkage right now because you can't follow where the information technology is being invested. All we're asking for is some accountability whereby we're able to say, oh, they made this technology investment, meet this part of the Oregon University System's business plan. We haven't modified your business plan. We haven't tried to do anything else by this bill. This bill only says make the technology investment linked to the business plan, and if not, maybe you're going to find some things that are actually falling off the table. Maybe you'll be able to find the money to do this, because right now, nothing's linked. Nobody's following it. Nobody's making any business planning decisions that they've been able to produce criteria by which they're going to make a technology. How do you decide to invest in that computer over it? How do you decide to make a $3,000 to $5,000 investment every time you put in a new machine? There's no linkage. The university system has not provided us anything regarding that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would say that I think I've tried to provide to you a picture of how the processes work at the campus level. It's not satisfactory to the members of this committee in terms of what you're seeking in the legislation and trying to capture in that way. But I agree to that.
Where did you provide any information except by saying that something occurs? We've not seen any documentation or an example of how the process works.
Mr. Chairman,
you've read off a list of things and held up documents that were created in 1995 that say this is what we're going to go do. But you know, if I'm not mistaken, after 1995, Oregon State University was still $6 million over their IT budget after that document was produced. And so how do we account for that?
Mr. Chairman, in that particular case, that was a trailing issue which came forward under the kind of centralized process in which all revenue went into one bucket. It all went into one place.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
had budget.
That's a great excuse. So any problems that arise to the surface, you find about it, then we can just simply say, oh, that's a trailing issue.
Well,
and I guess the question is, how many other trailing issues exist out in the system? Because it goes down to the fundamental. If you cannot demonstrate how you manage these dollars, how do we understand how much money to give you?
Mr. Chairman, in response to your question, both of your questions, as I said, I attend each one of the Administrative Affairs Councils and have for the last 8 years, and I can guarantee you that that particular deficit is the largest by a magnitude of probably 50, anything else I've ever heard. And the second thing I would say would be to repeat my earlier testimony, which is to say that in the current scheme, those kinds of things are not spread out, but are responsibilities of those who made the decision, so that both the budget decision and the accountability for the outcome are vested in the same place in the decision maker's desk. So it isn't spread all out over the place, and you are, in fact, accountable.
So
you won't find
the accountability down here, but how does the accountability reach back up so the chancellor can come back to this body and demonstrate that the dollars that they were given for their mission were spent appropriately and judiciously? But the response we keep on getting is, well, if you want to get in your car and drive to any of the seven campuses, you can go to any of the department levels, you can ask them if they were accountable, because we have no reports, we have no mechanism to demonstrate to the legislature that the dollars are managed and any reports that flow up. But
be assured, because Grant and Karen's attend the meeting, that everything is okay.
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman, I'd go back to the FASM report and underline one of the principles, and that is reduce prior approvals and assure accountability through auditing. And in fact, that is a balance. One of the things that happened after the enactment of the Higher Education Administrative Efficiency Act was that the Internal Audit Division became larger. The Chancellor's Office became smaller, but that division became larger. It was to say, you are empowered, here are the guidelines, here are the administrative rules, and here are the goals. Go forth and do good, collaboratively and opportunistically, and we will also audit to make sure that...
Okay, then, great. Then is that the group that we should have sitting before us telling us about the budget, because they're the only ones who seem to understand how the process works? And so that's what I'm trying to understand. Where is the information that is relied upon that the Chancellor rolls up to the Chancellor so the Chancellor can come before us and say, we judiciously invested, spent these dollars to the benefit of the students who attend and to the citizens of the state of Oregon? Where is that report? How do we get that information?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to give you that declarative statement under oath today, but that wouldn't serve your purpose. My understanding is that the system is at work gathering much of the data, which would be captured regularly and automatically by the imposition of this statute, and that they will deliver it to you in good time. My understanding is that they reported to you yesterday, and you said that would be satisfactory because it would come before the work session on our bill, and your report from your subcommittee to the education subcommittee would be made in a timely fashion. That was my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Karen.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Is there anything?
Are you headed for work session? I have a question.
We need to fix the amendment, so we'll be bringing it back on Tuesday.
Okay. When we do, I have a question to ask. If we do proceed down this road, I need to have the assurance that we are not going to lose the benefits of Senate Bill 271 for the OUS system. It's critically important to me that we preserve that advantage for our students. And
Representative Law, I'm sure that in terms, I don't think requiring a connection and a business plan associated with investment of information technology dollars is going to in any way jeopardize 271. I think in terms of what it will do is empower the university to better manage their dollars. And I'm more than happy to vest that responsibility within the university system, but Mr. Cairns didn't hold up a piece of paper that said vest the issues in 372 within the university, within the U.S. system. And so I don't have any assurance in terms of in the statements that they'll actually go do it, because it'll be, you know, 10th on their list, and it's not very important to them, these issues. And so it becomes a question of which agency we have the trust in to vest, to report back to the legislature this information which we can use. And so, but I don't think that it will cause any problems in terms of the independence, in terms of how they spend the dollars. It's simply putting and saying an assistant says, create a plan, spend your money to the plan, and be able to articulate that plan back. And I think in terms of that's the concern that we've seen in terms of that, the inability of the university system to demonstrate any of those plans.
I don't think I have any problem with demanding accountability from any state agency at any level for how they spend tax dollars. And I don't think I've heard any state agency say that they object to doing that. And in fact, I think that's why OSP was, you know, it's going to be somewhat inconvenient to have to do a coordination at that level, but I do applaud and commend them for willing to give it a try in this direction, and I think it's just an accountability thing. So good for you. I'm grateful for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just a little shocked that the university system is going to opposed to this, because I think it gives them a tool in their toolbox that they desperately need based upon the presentations that we had before the committee earlier. They need this tool in their toolbox to say, this is what our university plan is for information technology. We're never able to front anyone fully as to what they'd like. But at least if they have a compelling plan, that can link it to the information technology investment, then we've got a plan, and they have a more compelling case. So,
and
you know, I would hope that the university system may want to take a look at this differently and embrace it. It's good sound management practice to link your investments to your plan. And, you know, the thing they may not like is because, you know, DAS, they can't proceed with a project without DAS giving them certification on the project. But, you know, we have to have some accountability when we're outside the building. So I guess I'm...
Well, it's uncomfortable, there's no question. But the good news is that when people of Oregon send their kids to college and have to pay that god-awful tuition, you know, we won't at least have to explain away the idea that maybe the universities aren't being accountable with how they spend money on this sort of stuff. So we could at least foreclose that one thing and maybe have a better handle for the next legislature to say, hey, these are real expenses, and let's give them some money for tuition. Let's beef that up. So it's their fault, but it's our fault, too, for not knowing what their problems are.
With that, let's close the work session on House Bill 3372. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3678. Mark, you want to let us know what you're talking about?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3678 establishes requirements for telephone directories published by telecommunications utilities. Members of the committee.
Thanks, Mark. Jim Long. Welcome to committee, Mr. Long.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here today.
I've got a number of things to pass out to you.
If Mark, if you can give him a hand, that would be great. Mr. Long.
Thank you. My name is Jim Long. I live in North Plains, Oregon, in Washington County. I was down in the Capitol in January and out in the hall right out here, and I was taking a book. I'm an author. I'd taken a book over to the gift shop, have them see if they're interested in selling it, and there were 60 people in uniform out there. And I tap on the nearest shoulder, and it was a deputy from Washington County. I said, well, who's head of this, and what is it? And they said, it's the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And Jim Spinden is the head of it. And Jim Spinden's the sheriff from Washington County. And I go over to him and talk to him, showing my book about women. And I have a picture in there, the only woman who's ever been a sheriff in Oregon history. And I thanked him because I got the photo from the State Sheriff's Association. And then as we're ending our conversation, I say, I'm going to take initiative to the county commissioners, and perhaps you can help me. It's that Verizon took a 20-page human service guide out of our phone books. And before I had it out of my mouth, he says, we should mandate that statewide. You go up to Representative Williams' office. Let's get some language drafted about that. The bill you have in front of you is the language that I supplied and then legislative council had redone. And I do have some amendments to that. There's some things that are a little out of balance and I think will need to be improved upon as far as who actually publishes directories. Do telephone utilities actually publish directories, or is it their subsidiaries? So I've got 25 years of research, or of social science research, working for all levels of government, and I've done things in the e-field. I produced the first interactive cable television in the Northwest, and I had a whole channel of cable television for a couple of years where people could interact with it. Both Quest and Verizon have printed my address incorrectly in phone books, over 1 million phone books in the state. And they've done that, and it's also incorrect on the Internet. Anyway, I came down here, and I'm an advocate for the information poor. Those people who do not have access to computers, who are not online, who cannot get information that way. There's a number of people that way. Hard copy print information is essential for the information poor. Telephone books serving Oregon communities need to be improved for public health and public safety. The first place people turn looking for help is still the telephone book. I've passed out to you a copy of last year's telephone book. It has a 20-page human service guide in it. Part of it is in bilingual. The first listings of it are 24-hour, 7-day-a-week emergency numbers like rape crisis, suicide prevention, domestic violence resources, Oregon Poison Center. And these are a natural progression from the inside front cover of the phone book, which is dedicated to other 24-hour emergency numbers. I began my advocacy in this in 1977. I took it to the Public Utility Commission. The commission said, well, let's talk to the companies. We talked to the companies. The commission came out with letters saying, this is an improvement. You can either do this on your own or we will tell you to do this. So it's been on a volunteer basis in the 1970s through the 80s. In the 80s, I came back and did a rulemaking petition in front of the Public Utility Commission. They justified the fact that I had shown them a lot of inadequacies. They did an investigation, and they found that there were still numerous inadequacies in the phone books. This is 10 years later. Of 54 editions, only 70% had blue pages and 65% had a human service guide. Now, the problem here is, and this is very important, and I hope you can ask questions of the telephone industry about this, and it even says it on the Quest website. I was looking at that today. It says that business telephone customers are entitled to a single light line classified listing. Research I had done in the 70s and 80s, 90s, and here in this century has shown that there's a number of agencies, public and nonprofit agencies, that are not getting that listing. Why? I don't know. I proposed this alternative listing system, this human service guide, and it's been very positive and been very helpful for people. But, like I say, there's a classified listing that's not being given in the printed phone books, it's not on the CDs, it's not on their online services. So, you know, if we're going to be advancing government in this committee, we need to advance it and advance it properly in print, CDs, and online. There's a point to be made here that if you're going to do it, you know, they should start out doing it right and they should continue doing it right. That's the way to move forward. I've done an analysis of the current phone books. I've only found about 36 of them. The libraries don't have as many phone books anymore because the phone companies are requesting that they buy them. They used to give them for free, but now they have to buy them. Volunteer implementation by the companies doesn't seem to be working. As I said, this 450 agencies in the Washington County phone book have been omitted by Verizon, and at this point they're going to continue it. This is a trend that's happening elsewhere in the state. People in Coos Bay at the human service agencies there have been told that a 15-page human service guide is going to be taken out of their book. Is there a good reason for it? I don't know. Doesn't seem like there is. Some of these numbers are for survival's sake, and people need them. My recent analysis show there's no standardization of content, format, or placement of the human services listings. Half a dozen editions of telephone directories in the state don't even have a human service guide. A handful of editions do not even consolidate the government offices and schools. So the real problem here is that unless, you know, if you're using a phone book, and the phone book is there listing the numbers so that people can communicate, if you don't know the name of an agency, you're not going to find it in the white pages. And if it's not in the classified section, you're just not going to be able to find it. So if people are looking for help, they're in trouble. Most all editions now list human services in a separate section, but there are variations in color of the pages. There are blue pages, there are gray pages, there are green pages, there are white pages. At first glance, it appears that many telephone books are not in compliance with the 1991 Oregon law regarding the emergency telephone system 911. And you have a letter in front of you from the Oregon State Police. Ken Keim, the head of 911, brought the letters in. I passed them out to you. The state police support this because this is a continuation of 911. It's to help them. It reduces calls to 911. And it's a good place for referral for people who have an immediate problem. Okay, the law that requires 24-hour, 7-day-a-week life and death services such as organ poison drill, suicide prevention counseling to be on the inside front cover or page one, the emergency telephone page, under the 911 listing. However, numerous Oregon counties do not have a 24-hour mental health number, and many of them, it isn't even listed in the phone book whatsoever. Of the Quest telephone directories, for example, Portland, Milwaukee, Eugene, Medford, they are now including a 4-to-10-page expanded federal government agency listing. This federal government agency listing, and I wish I'd had the wherewithal to bring down phone books for you, but you can check in your local phone books. They have an expanded federal listing. It has blue ink for the agency.
I love it. It's great.
And it even has URLs, you know, website URLs for people. So this relates to your committee pretty directly. And but what it doesn't do, it doesn't include state agencies. It doesn't include county agencies. It doesn't include city services. It doesn't classify these services, nor does it classify the private nonprofits. Online, as I said, Questdex says business customers are entitled to a single light listing under classification of their choice. It would be worthwhile for you folks to know how many business customers do not receive that listing. The Quest CDs and online blue pages and community service numbers are not easy to find, and they duplicate these mistakes. This shows inadequacies in both yellow pages in print and online. Okay, so what you have in front of you is a bill. The proposed bill would make the telephone book a more valuable tool for people in need. It will create a blue section at the front of the directory that is an extension of the emergency telephone number page. It will save lives and connect people in need with essential services. The blue pages section will be at the front of the directory, and the human service guide will list first the survival 24-hour emergency numbers like 911, organ poison drill, FBI, rape crisis, domestic violence, child abuse, elder abuse, followed by other available human services. The blue pages will help enable the state of Oregon to fulfill some of its benchmarks. For production issues, we're not really talking about blue paper. These are not blue pages that are not recyclable. We're talking about the technology there. They spray blue-bordered ink around it so they're more recyclable. The way I started this was to have advisory committees putting together the human service guides because the telephone company isn't interested and doesn't know much about the human services field. They haven't listed them for years. They're not a money-making part of their business, and they just haven't paid any attention to them. Legal issues. I don't have the letter right in front of me, but I have a couple letters from the Department of Justice saying that it does seem, quote, it does seem that numerous service agencies are paying for a service which they are not receiving at the present time. They refer to it as alleged misrepresentation. As far as financial issues, in 1977, General Telephone and Northwest revenue and expense figures show they made 447% profits on phone books in Oregon. The most recent figures from earlier this session indicates the GT revenues are over $14 million with profits in excess of 200%. U.S. West is close to that. Enactment of this bill will result in minimal additional costs to the telephone utilities and its publishers. It can be strongly argued that for decades, government offices, schools, and human services have been missing classified listings that were paid for with tax dollars and that these listings are deserved. So the amendment that needs to happen, I believe, is the definition of telecommunications utility. I'm not sure that telecommunications utilities are the ones that publish the phone books. It might be a subsidiary of theirs. There's more than, you know, there are customers who buy the whole database from the phone company and print them. The two competing phone books in Washington County are doing wonderful blue pages. They're better than Verizon's. They have the listings. So I don't see the idea of the notion of competition to be a problem in this. This should be a cooperative, coordinated system. So please, like I say, I recommend looking into amending the language in there so it's more conforming with what should be occurring. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Brant Wolf and Shelley Jensen, you want to come up together?
welcome.
Chairman Hill, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. I've listed on the second page of my testimony handed out to the members of our association. Basically, the OTA is opposed to House Bill 3678 for a couple of different reasons. Principally, our main objection to this is the fact that we believe this is just an unnecessary intrusion into the business of the telephone utilities. I did happen to ring along a couple of telephone directories, some visual aids. This is the telephone directory for Meacham, and this is the telephone directory for Helix. Now, granted, these are the extreme. However, the point is there is no room for a blue section. If Helix Telephone Company had to create and print and distribute a blue section, it would be larger than the actual telephone directory for the city of Helix. Despite that, City of Helix does include all the information Mr. Long pointed out. It's got poison control, 911, fire, all those kinds of things, schools. It's all listed in here. Much of the government information is not listed as the bill dictates. It's down in the body of the directory itself, the schools, the swimming pool, things of those nature. I brought a couple of other directories, a little larger, but the point still, they're small. They contain, in some cases, a lot more information than the bill requires. Again, it's not blue. It's not in the location that the bill would mandate, but we believe that the telephone companies are doing a fine job already in regards to what this bill is about. The second point I'd like to make is that a lot of these companies, telephone utilities, don't publish these directories themselves. They shop that out to contractors. A lot of these contracts have some pretty strict deadlines, and if the government entity is not willing or not able to get the information to the directory publisher in time, there are some hefty fees, I suppose you could say, or fines for not getting the information to them on time, and that could run into some serious money. So you have my written testimony. That's about the extent of my knowledge of telephone directory in their publication and distribution. I will be happy to answer any questions you might have for me. And that's the end of my testimony.
So,
Shelley Jansen, I'm Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for Verizon. We are also opposed to this bill, and basically for most of the same reasons that Brant outlined, is we don't think this is the kind of thing that should be mandated in state law. For one thing, it doesn't take into account differences between communities. Some of these things that would be mandated don't really make any sense in some of the smaller communities. Transit maps, for example, in Elgin probably wouldn't be real necessary, but we apparently would have to put something in. I wanted to address a couple of the issues that Mr. Long brought up. I'm a bit confused about the 911 issue, because I remember last session there was a bill that passed that mandates where the 911 information has to be, and it has to be on the top of the page, and only certain other emergency kinds of things can be below that. So that's already covered by a state statute, how that's displayed in the phone book. The issue of the human services pages, we are discontinuing them for a kind of interesting reason. It's not because of the cost. It's because we had a vendor who compiled all of that information for us. The vendor no longer provides that service. We published the pages for a year or two after the vendor stopped providing us with the information, and the numbers started being wrong. In fact, in one case, the suicide hotline number was wrong, and we have not been able to find someone to take on that service for us. It's not something that our folks who publish the directories can do, because a lot of times the name of the organization that provides the service doesn't relate to what service they provide. So if you're not from the community, you don't necessarily know. For example, I looked in one of our phone books, and it has under animal hospitals, it has Dove Lewis Emergency Hospital. Well, if you're not familiar with Dove Lewis Emergency Hospital, you don't know that that's an animal hospital and not a people hospital, so you wouldn't know where to list it. So that's, I mean, we would be perfectly happy to, if there's someone who would like to compile those that information, we'd be more than happy to reinstate that. And so that's kind of all I've got to say.
Any questions? Thank you. Karen Haley and Jackson Zimmer.
She's on. Hold on. Here she is.
Karen Haley. State your name for the record.
Okay, my name is Karen Haley. I live in Beaverton, Washington County area. And I'm a widow, and I live by myself. And I support this legislator bill of 3678. I was married for 26 years, and my husband recently just passed away. And he would, at the time when I was married to him, he would not let me go out and work outside of the home. So I was told that I did not have any qualifications to go out and get a job. So looking, I think both poor and rich people should be able to find what they look for in the telephone books, young and old, and listings for services for the government offices, for social and school should be easier to find. The phone book in my apartment doesn't include the human service sections this year like it did last year. I couldn't find agencies for agency assistance, legal aid, OHSU health services, employment, and training in this year's version or quest. Telephone books. I could find those numbers from last year's, but I recycled those books before I realized that the new ones did not have them. Putting the section on blue board pages would make it easier to find. I tried calling a number to the motor vehicles 2 weeks ago when I was missing a license plate. I called the only number which was in the book, which was 503-299-9999, and I had to wait and wait for them not to answer the telephone. And when the answer recording came up, all I could get was that the motor vehicles was closed. So the next day, I waited and called the same number, and I was told the same thing. So I had to call 411 to call long distance to Salem so that I could find out what I was supposed to do. So please fix the phone book so people can find the telephone numbers, and please support this legislation. And it's a good idea for phone companies can afford it and should improve their books.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer, and I'm the director of O4AD, the Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and also I'm the co-chair of HISCO, which is the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. Both associations have taken a position in support of this particular piece of legislation. Just a couple things I want to point up. I'm just kind of here to do cleanup, and one of them is that we don't believe that what we're asking for in here is fluffy stuff. And if you look in the telephone book, it's chock full of fluffy stuff, which is very nice, and we appreciate some of it, I'm sure. But the previous person that was testifying from the Oregon Telecommunications Association, I'm sorry if I misrepresented their title, said they don't believe that they should be mandated to, you know, state government shouldn't mandate them. We do have a voter's registration form in the telephone book. I'm pretty sure that we mandated that somewhere along the line. You can actually register to vote using your telephone book. So when people need phone numbers, they are actually going to a phone book for them. That's what phone books are for, is phone numbers. We don't go to a cookbook when we want to find a number. We go to the phone book. So it makes sense that you would be able to find community information there. For a lot of folks, a 75-cent call to 411, especially when you're, again, not quite sure the name of the agency that you're calling, it can end up costing you more than 75 cents as you make several different calls trying to figure out who your resources are. I was at a 7-Eleven not too long ago, and a woman was at the payphone thumbing through the phone book when I went in, and she was there when I came out, and she looked at me and she said, "I can't find the number for this drug and alcohol thing." I'm supposed to go to this drug and I don't know where to find this. And, you know, she really just didn't quite have all the skills that she needed. And I said, there's blue pages in the phone book and you can find them in there. And I helped her get where she needed to go by being able to refer her to that. By me being able to say there is such a thing as blue pages. That's sort of common knowledge around the state that there are blue pages and that's where you go for resource information. I think phone books, you know, I know it's expensive to produce a phone book. I can appreciate that. But bless their hearts, they've done things like added the name of the second person in your house. They've added your zip code. I mean, they're actually, it's very space intensive, but they're adding information to phone books all the time. So standardized information about community resources seems a useful addition to a phone book. I think that some of their objections are valid. You have a very small phone book. You certainly wouldn't want to weigh it down with 20 pages of community. My guess is that you don't have 20 pages worth of community information in a town the size of whatever little borough it was that they showed you today. There could be a senior center, maybe. There could be one information referral number, I'm not certain, but I doubt there's 20 pages worth of community services there. My guess is further that that area, because telephone companies like to use their tool as an advertisement, people get big phone books all the time. I get two or three a year from companies I don't even know. So they probably have access to other community information through a bigger phone book. There was one other thing I wanted to mention to you today. My sense is that we could probably, if I was a phone company, maybe this is something I'd want to do to make me look good. Phone companies are big. People see them sponsoring big events all the time. They do good things, and I think this is one more good thing that they could do. I would think that it would be worthwhile to have people sit down and talk about some common things that could be in every phone book that serves a community over a certain size. I think you ought to, if they don't choose to step up to the plate and do something like this themselves, that's why we're here. It has to be mandated that they do it.
Jim, can you come up? Verizon says the reason why they stopped doing the second is that there isn't someone to get the information from. In terms of, how do the area agency, you know, maybe it's the community action organization or something, in terms of go have a conversation, and try to, work this out in terms of it's an unwillingness, it's more of a business problem in terms of who do we get the information from, who's going to be ultimately responsible for collecting and collating the data. And my suggestion in terms of maybe we can go and talk and maybe we don't need to mandate something because they're very willing to go do it. It's a business problem in terms of, and perhaps there's an opportunity here to those agencies that have a need to be there could step forward and present the information to them in a format and take the responsibility to say, I'll give you my information. At a minimum, maybe it's two pages because only the agencies that are willing to sort of go together and say, we will maintain and we will provide the information necessary for this. And then I think somebody can become a lead on it. And I think some of the other problems that I see in terms of maybe it isn't a phone book, but it's in terms of how the state manages access to state services. In terms of it won't address necessarily community-based programs and things, but I'm sure you could probably solve those problems, is this issue in terms of who I call, I need to call the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I need to call the construction contractors board because I had a problem, with X, or it's kind of working on a operator for the state of Oregon who says, hi, state of Oregon,
mm-hmm.
this is my problem. When he's, they're smart to tell you where to go in terms of maybe a couple of different themes because we've become so decentralized, is that there's not a central place that ties all the different missions together. Maybe that's probably maybe a conversation that we can have, because we'll be talking about telecom stuff anyways. It means, I think, in terms of some different themes here of how we solve the very same problem, but without going and saying, you're going to be responsible for collating a bunch of information,
you know, and it's sort of, you know, are they going to be responsible to seek out these organizations in terms of, you know, I don't know how you mandate that you print it if, you know, and I step and say, wait a minute, you violated the law because you didn't put my phone number there and I'm a, you know, a private drug and alcohol center. You know, how does a phone company know who you're supposed to be? That's right. So maybe there's some opportunity here to talk and we can work something out. And so I think, because what I heard from Verizon is it was just simply, give me the information and we'll print it.
Community Action, I was on an advisory committee that put it together back in 1980 originally, and Washington County Community Action Organization has been updating it for years. They do incur some expense doing that, though, and it's not so much a problem, and you know, they run an information referral center, so they have all the up-to-date information. But it takes some, it's been done on a volunteer basis in the past, but Verizon seems to be wanting to drop the ball now and say, we don't want to do it, and that's just not adequate for us.
That I have from our directory, folks, is that Community Action Organization is the one we used to use and who isn't providing it any longer.
So, Jim, answer the question in terms of, I mean, what is Verizon? You're the phone company. How do you go out to collate all this information that it's, you know, Jim's Alcohol and Drug Center?
They have all the numbers. They have all the numbers from the previous year.
But they don't, Jim, the point is that, you know, Shelley testified that the problem is they did that because they stopped doing it and they printed the wrong number for the suicide prevention number, because if there's not somebody who's updating responsible for that, you know, I mean, you know, I don't know who's responsible and who's going to take the lead and take responsibility for creating those numbers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can appreciate the perspective that you're presenting us with and the opportunity to step out and see if there isn't something that we can do that sounds more like common ground. And if they're willing, we're certainly willing to work with them. We have one of the biggest state agencies is just down the street. It's the Department of Human Services. It's working towards the goal of single entry system for all of its programs. They have, I mean, I believe that by pulling them in as well, we have opportunities and methods for publishing numbers, and we can appreciate the fact that we don't want the phone company to have to overwork themselves in order to get this sort of information, but I think that we could probably work something out there.
Yeah, according to our director people there in Dallas, that's part of the reason why they don't necessarily know if if an organization isn't called Suicide Hotline Organization, but it's called, you know, the Partridge Foundation or something, they don't necessarily know what kind of services they provide. So we would be happy to continue publishing, but our concern is we did, when we published previous year's information, we did get complaints from the agencies that the calls weren't getting to them because their numbers had changed. And they might have been updated in the white pages because that's where their number was listed, but there wasn't a carryover to update them in the human services section.
Right, and
that's the concern.
Mr. Chair, just to add a twist of humor to it, it's very interesting. Our Clackamas County Social Services Office, along with several of our other offices, has had their phone number changed on them by various phone companies just in the last year since the last phone book came out. And while certain things roll over for a certain period of time, at some point they stop rolling over. And so we're aware that numbers are not going to be correct. And I don't mean to be flippant. I mean, if you don't have a current suicide phone number and that's the service that you need right now, that's truly unfortunate. But a lot of times the numbers aren't correct because they're changed on us because of you have the understanding about why that happens.
Mm-hmm. I have a comment if I can. As I'm sitting here looking at the samples, blue pages that have been provided for us as an exhibit for this hearing, I'm looking at the government state offices, and it's the Hillsborough phone book, apparently. And Representative Hill, you're not in there.
It might
be great if you were.
I will add my comments to that in terms of, I know that Senator Hamby has worked for years trying to figure out how to get her number into
to the pages, and she doesn't know how it ever occurred, but she was successful, because and then the problem is then everyone calls you, you know, and she receives people calling her from all over Washington County.
And
she was a good person and always helped. I mean, people not even in her district. But in terms of...
I'd like Representative Lowe's number listed in my phone.
But I am in the white pages, so...
So, Mr. Chair, the direction is...
I think in terms of... There seems to be common ground here in terms of how to work this out. So maybe let's go back and maybe we could find a lead agency who would take the lead in terms of compiling the database and the information. But my concern is that that may be good for state agencies. I don't know if the state agency is going to take responsibility in collating the private things in terms of maybe this is a conversation that needs to be had and Verizon can come to the table and understand in terms of how to work this out. I don't know what data they need or how they need it. But I think in terms of there seems to be common ground, so I'd say let's go out and have a conversation of can we do this without a bill? And if not, then we'll address that at the right time.
Mr. Chair, I believe there's very few agencies that provide community services in the state that don't have some connection to the state in some form or another. So they'll probably clobber me when I get out of here, but it might work.
They probably will, Jackie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 3678? Hearing seeing none, we'll close public hearing on House Bill 3678. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2038. Just to update, I think we're going to find a public records bill that has a relating clause to public records. We're going to move here so we can combine all the issues into one so we'll be able to do the internet as well as the financial. I think we have an understanding in terms of what everyone has agreed to. We just need a corporate relating clause. I spoke with Representative Wilson today, and he's identified one that we might be able to get moved here into the committee to address all the issues together and deal with it in one issue, which I think would be clean. So we will simply await that decision in terms of getting it here. If not, we'll readdress the issue again. So with that, I will close public hearing. So 2038, and with no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.
Happy Easter, everybody.